You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Living an active lifestyle is one way to keep ourselves healthy and mobile as we age. But as our bodies change with time, our fitness routines may have to change along with it. Our next guest is a physical therapy expert joining us with advice on how to adapt our exercise habits so we can stay active well into old age. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have your exercise habits changed as you age? What are some activities you've been able to keep doing as you've gotten older? What are some you've left behind? Or have you found new ways to get exercise over the years or decades? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Carlin Ault is a clinical associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Milwaukee. Carlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's my pleasure to be here.
Before we get into the how, let's talk a little bit about the why. Carlin, what are the benefits of keeping exercise going, keeping fitness going as we get older?
Well, as we age, our muscles and bones can change a little bit, and it's important to stay strong, especially in those functional muscle groups that help us get up and down off of the ground, get in and out of chairs, cars, those sorts of things. And it is true, if you don't use it, you will lose it. So it's especially important through the aging process to continue to load our muscles and bones and continue to push ourselves so we have the stimulus to add more muscle and bone.
You know, the workout my 20-year-old daughters might be doing now might not be right for me. How do we evaluate as we get older, you know, this is the appropriate thing to accomplish those goals you just lined out? This maybe isn't the thing I do anymore.
Well, of course, everything is individualized. If you have any underlying conditions or you're on certain medications, those things can make a difference. But you may be able to do a lot of the exercises that your 20-year-old daughter is doing. So don't sell yourself short. We want to make sure that we're continuing to strengthen our muscles. And the good news is, while we have some physiological and biological changes in our tissues with aging, the good news is those tissues are still very responsive to appropriate loading. So you can add muscle mass, you can add some strength to your bone, or slow down the rate of the decline by staying active. I always like to say we all need to move more and sit less. And anything that you do is better than nothing. So that's a good place to start.
That is. Let's talk about strength a little bit. You mentioned some key muscle groups for doing things like getting up and down, things like that. What are some of the muscle groups we might focus on? What are some good entry points to exercising those zones?
Yeah, that's a great question. I focus a lot on sit to stand or being able to get up off of the floor. As we're aging, or really at any age, we can sometimes find ourselves on the floor. But as you are aging and becoming a little bit weaker, which is part of the normal aging process, is you do lose some muscle mass, to make sure you're focusing on the muscles that are used for functional tasks. So if you're sitting in a chair and you stand up, you need your glutes, which is your backside, and your quads on the front of your thigh to be able to help you lift your body weight to be able to stand up. So anything that's involving some sit-to-stand activities are very important for those muscle groups. Also, the outside of your hips, when we walk, we stand on one leg for part of the time and we're swinging the other leg. So making sure the outside of our leg muscles are nice and strong so we stay stable. It's all about reducing your risk of having a fall, because falls can really disrupt your life, and staying strong will allow you to be able to better able to catch yourself or prevent yourself from falling. But at least if you find yourself on the floor, you've got the muscle strength to get back up.
And then how about keeping our cardiovascular exercise going over time?
Yeah, that's another great question. So a muscle is muscle. So the heart is a muscle, and we have to exercise that just like we exercise our peripheral muscles. And the target heart rate the heart rate, you want to work hard enough that you're challenging your muscles, whether it's a muscle in your thigh or your heart muscle. So we always do need to be pushing ourselves a little bit above what our daily level of function is. For cardiovascular exercise, you want to be trying to get around 60 to 80% of your heart rate for whatever period of time you can do that for. the guideline is 150 minutes per week of moderate physical activity. So if you break that up, if you're doing a little over 30 minutes or so per day of aerobic physical activity, that is a good place to start. But you'd like to push yourself a little more than just what you're typically used to doing.
Talking to Carlin Ault, clinical associate professor at UW-Milwaukee on physical therapy, talking about our changing exercise and fitness needs as we age. You can join in with your questions or your story at 800-642-1234. James is with us now in Fountain City. James, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. Say, I'm 75, and I started with endurance sports, in the late 70s or so, doing Birkebeiners, cross-country ski races, all of the Midwest, and I've continued on mountain bike series. In fact, I'm on my way right now to a canoe workout, which is pretty intense canoeing since I live near Winona and the home of Winona Canoes. And plus, I'm a master swimmer. All I can say for people listening to this is you don't quit. You know, you don't quit unless you literally can't get up off a chair, but I'm a big proponent of staying active. I mean, I lift at the Y, I do all these things. I don't know where I got that from. Must be genetics or something, but.
I think it helps if it's fun too, right? Mm-hmm. When it's a fun activity, it's a lot easier for you to go out and participate. I also think it's wonderful that you're doing a great combination of upper extremity exercises. Canoeing is going to work your arms and your upper body. Swimming is upper body. Cross-country skiing, biking, both lower extremity exercises. They'll all get your heart working with cardiovascular work, and none of them are really jarring or loading to your lower extremity joints. Some people can develop some arthritis and some pain in their hips and knees with the aging process. You don't have to, but some people do. Those individuals would tolerate something like skiing or biking better than running and jogging. So picking the type of exercise, even though it's in a category of aerobic or strength training, is important.
James, thanks a lot for sharing that. Keep it up. Now, James is a wee bit older than I am. I'm not doing anywhere near as much exercise as James is. Carlin, I do walk a fair amount. I don't know. Does walking count?
Oh, that's a great question. Walking can count for general exercise outside. So if you're walking at a pace where you're starting to breathe a little bit heavier, you can carry on a conversation, but you're not huffing and puffing. That's probably moderate intensity, and there's nothing wrong with doing that if your goal is to get outside, work your heart muscle a little bit. If you wanted to be making your bones stronger or adding mass to your muscles, you would need to do something a little bit more than that. Doesn't mean that walking's not good. It means you can maybe mix and match different activities so you can accomplish all the goals that you're looking for. For adding some strength to your bones, you really need a little more impact. So you could walk maybe with trekking poles, and you'd be pounding your poles into the pavement while you're walking. That would be more of an impact load, if that makes sense.
Sure. Let's go to another caller now. Lyric is with us in Blanchardville. Lyric, hi.
Hi. A few years ago, I got injured and had a brain concussion, and the best medicine for me was that walking in water the Upland Hills and Dodgeville has, where you walk across the floor to an area and it lowers down into a pool that's about 9 feet wide and maybe 16 feet long. The water, if your knees or your ankles are injured, the water supports your body weight, and in front of you is a bar that you can hang on if you've got a balance problem, so you feel very safe. You can tell them how high you want the jets of water that are moving in the pool and how deep you want it. But my favorite thing was that the endorphins that your body gets when you're walking in that water is like the best antidepressant in the world, and it lasts 2 or 3 days at least. It's wonderful.
Lyric, thank you so much for sharing that. And that's, Carlin, for people who can't have a lot of impact, that could be a great option, it sounds like.
That is a great option. And she's absolutely right that when you can participate in an activity that makes you feel good and you do have the endorphin release, you know you're doing something positive for your body. But when it's fun and it's enjoyable, you're going to stick with it. And of course, for all of us, that's the real trick, is being able to find something that we can continue to do because it's fun and we enjoy it and it makes us feel good.
Lyric, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Carlin Ault, clinical professor of physical therapy at UW-Milwaukee, about how to adapt our exercise habits, our fitness routines, as we get older to help keep us mobile and healthy. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What goals do you have for remaining active as you age? Are there recreational or practical activities that you're worried about having to leave behind? Our guest might be able to help you find something that could replace it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Carlin Ault, Clinical Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about how we can change our workout, our fitness routine as we get older, so we can continue to live active and healthy lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a lifelong exerciser? How did that change over the years, if at all? Have you hit an age where you're thinking, I got to start doing some stuff? Because you have a sedentary normal person job, like radio host. I don't know. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Juneau. Jim, hello.
Hello. Yes, thanks for taking the call. Anyways, I'm 60 this year, and during COVID, I tried seeing what retiring would look like, and I can't do it. And so I gave up my job that I had, and now I'm back into construction. I'll tell you what, it was hard getting going, but daggone it, I've never felt this good in my life, you know?
Jim, did you do exercise, apart from the exercise involved in the construction work itself? Like, were you doing stuff to build up to that?
Yeah. During the winter, I went ahead because they don't hire in the winter. So during the winter, I got a membership at the Y, and I made sure that I was, you know, doing the treadmills, walking the block around here, lifting a little weight to try and make sure that I wasn't going to strain something right out the gate. But, yeah.
I love it, Jim. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. Carlin, sounds like Jim was really smart about getting back into construction work there.
Yeah. Yes. Construction is certainly a physical job that will keep you using your muscles most definitely. One comment I do want to add to what Jim said is that the target, if most of us are going to the gym and working on muscle strengthening, we want to make sure that we're working hard enough that we're going to get some benefit out of it. And that is, in physical therapy term, we'd be looking at like 60 to 80% of your one rep max, meaning the most that you can lift. But that's a little complicated for most of us to do when we go to the gym. But if you think about it in the number of repetitions you could do on an exercise, if I'm doing bicep curls to make my bicep, my upper arm stronger, I should be lifting a weight that's heavy enough that by the time I get to number 10, I could almost not do one more repetition. If I'm aiming for 10 repetitions, I'm probably at about 75% of my one rep max, which means I'm going to be giving my body a stimulus to add more muscle, add more protein. Anywhere between 8 and 12 is good, but 10 is kind of around that sweet spot. So that might help people, is if you can do 30 and you think you're adding muscle mass, you need to push yourself a little harder with a heavier weight, so you can't do quite so many reps. That's the stimulus to add your muscle. And I'm sure that Jim is doing that when he's working construction, lifting heavy loads.
Jim, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Kenny is with us now in Rice Lake. Kenny, hi. Were you there, Kenny?
Yeah.
Hi. What did you want to tell us about?
I'm a welder by trade, and oftentimes in the shop I work in, I hear from the gentleman my age or in our 60s that all you need to do is work hard, and that's going to help you stay in good shape. When I've learned over the years that I like to go to the gym and work out and ride bicycle and do aerobic activities, and it seems to keep you in much better shape than just, quote, working hard.
All right. And Kenny, have you talked your coworkers into going biking with you or hitting the gym with you?
Well, you know, they just don't seem to be really responsive to that. They don't want to jump in and go to the spin class at the gym, but maybe they will.
All right. Tell them we sent you, Kenny. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. Carlin, again, Kenny seems to be on the right track here.
Yeah, we have. Well, of course, we have wonderful listeners on public radio. They're,
yes.
They're all exercising. Terrific.
Kenny, thanks for the call. Carlin, one zone of exercise we haven't talked about a ton yet, related to you were talking about falls earlier, is balance. Now, when people are in their teens and 20s, they might not be thinking about balance as an exercise issue. Why does that get important? What can we do about it?
Balance is really important. Single leg balance, because if you think about standing at home and getting dressed, you're standing on one leg and have to put your leg through the other leg of the pants, or you have to sit down to be able to do that. So balance is important for walking, for transitions, for slippery surfaces. Often, getting up from sit to stand, you might have been dozing and you're startled. It's a real it's a danger zone when you're making transitions between sit to stand, and that does relate to balance. In addition to just having good muscle strength and the ability to kind of take all of your weight, our vision changes, our hearing changes. We might have a lot of wax built up in our ears. The vestibular system and your visual system also play a role in balance. I often think of getting up to go to the bathroom at night. If your house is completely dark, you have taken away, you're a little bit groggy, and you've taken away that visual system from being able to help you with your balance. So I'm a big fan of nightlights for aging population, so that as you take away some of those other supports for you to maintain good balance, vision and your vestibular system, that you're supporting yourself if you've got any changes in diabetes or poor range of motion in your legs that can affect your balance.
Talking to Carlin Ault from UW-Milwaukee, physical therapist there, talking about our changing exercise and fitness needs as we age. Back to your calls now with Kim in Mequon. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I have been a lifelong exerciser. I am 69 this year. I still downhill ski, cross-country ski, ride my bike. I mean, I started riding a bike in my teens. I have three bikes. I still ride them. I rode my bike to work today and back. And my job is teaching fitness classes for seniors. So I cannot tell you how many times I've had someone come to the classes new and start working out. We do weight training. We do a little cardio. And they will come back to me like 3 or 4 months later and say, hey, I just went to my doctor. And my doctor's like, what are you doing? Keep it up. Your blood pressure's down. You know, your stats are really, really good. So I just want to say, if anybody is a little older and hasn't worked out for a long time, don't let that stop you, because you can get back into the game.
Kim, thanks a lot for the call and the inspiration. Carlin, Kim pointing toward even within a few months, apparently doctors noticing a difference when people get back into exercise.
Yeah, and absolutely. And there are some studies that will show that even into your 90s, you can add muscle mass. So that the body is very adaptive. And so you can start at any age and you will see changes. It does take 6 weeks at least to start to get muscle mass changes, but you can see improvement sooner than that. It's more of a neuromuscular training effect, but absolutely, you can see physical changes, body changes, strength, endurance changes, and you just overall, you feel better. And I will put in a little plug for protein, because as we age, the body's ability to, the amount of protein that we need to take in to help build our muscles, that changes a little bit. So everyone, but especially our older adults, need to be eating protein with just about every meal, because that's helping to maintain that muscle health and muscle strength.
Kim, thanks again for the call and the inspiration. Carlin, you mentioned, people may have some different needs when it comes to exercise. I wanted to ask you about one of your specialties. You work with people on exercise and fatigue for survivors of cancer. What kind of different things might be at play there?
Well, cancer itself and all of the treatments for cancer can affect multiple systems in the body, can affect your heart muscle, so cardiovascular system. You can have a loss of extensibility, so things end up getting a little bit tight, can have some changes in your bone. So all systems can be affected either through cancer and or cancer treatment. And for some reason, we tend to not, we meaning the medical system, don't always routinely refer our patients who are undergoing or have completed treatment for cancer to physical therapy to get people back strength, muscle strength, cardiovascular conditioning. We don't do it in the same way that we do for heart attacks or for strokes or amputations. And that's really my mission, is to make sure that all cancer survivors, because there's millions of them, are treated with specific exercise to help people return back to a highly functional life. It's not just about surviving the treatment. It's about returning to thriving and having a really high quality of life, being strong and being able to enjoy every day because you do feel good.
Carlin, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Carlin Ault, Clinical Associate Professor of Physical Therapy at UW-Milwaukee. We talked to her today about how we can change our workout and fitness routines as we get older to help keep us active, hopefully for years to come. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, today's tweens and teens live a big part of their lives online, and it can be tough to navigate the social media world. The author of the new book, Growing Up in Public, shares advice and the benefits and the downsides of social media use for young people. You can get started with your questions, maybe your kids' experiences or your own experience as a kid. Email ideas@WPR.org. Plus, the U.S. Farm Bill has a big impact here in Wisconsin, from farmers to food consumers, school meals, and food assistance. Get the latest on efforts to pass a new farm bill in Congress. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, climate change brings up the risk of more extreme rainfall and flooding here in Wisconsin. We'll talk to a civil and environmental engineer about how prepared we are and what more we can do to be ready for those flooding events. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin has seen more frequent and severe flooding in recent years, and the growing impact of climate change is expected to make things worse in the future. A recent report published in the journal Climate Policy evaluated the Great Lakes states on their policies and programs for building local flood resilience. Wisconsin ranked near the middle. The state scored well in the categories of planning, guidance, and regulations and standards, while the report says Wisconsin falls behind other states in terms of providing funding and information for flood preparation. It's a complicated issue with no one-size-fits-all approaches for communities around the state with different geographies and infrastructure needs. But our next guest says there's a lot we can do to be better prepared for extreme rainfall and flooding in the future. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with flooding in your area? How prepared were you and your community? Do you think we need to do more to be ready for flooding? What questions do you have about our infrastructure and our flood preparedness? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel Wright is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison. He leads the Hydroclimate Extremes research group that studies rainfall and flooding. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've noted elsewhere, Daniel, that flooding isn't just about, you know, how much rain comes down and how quickly. Can you talk about the factors literally on the ground, the infrastructure, the environment that can make a rainstorm, a flood in one place and not in another?
Yeah, as you mentioned, it really does vary from place to place. And so when you're looking in areas around Wisconsin, oftentimes we need to worry about more than just rainfall. And so, for example, another really important factor is the soil itself. And so in particular, what we call the soil moisture. And so that's basically how much water is already in the soil, maybe from a rainstorm the day before or the week before, that can really impact how much runoff actually occurs when a big rainstorm hits. And so the wetter our soils are, the more severe the flood is going to be. The other thing that we have to worry about in Wisconsin and places nearby, at least in the springtime, is what happens when you have a lot of snow on the ground and then a storm comes. Because what happens in that case is that rain melts the snow that's there, and then you get runoff not only from the rain that falls, but from that melting snow as well.
Now, on the rainfall side of the equation, how much does climate change change our evaluation of risk here in the state?
Yeah, it's a really important factor, and the upper Midwest has really been one of the big hotspots for increases in extreme rainfall in the recent past. And so we all know here, just based on the difference that we feel when we go outside in wintertime versus summertime, that the warmer the air is, the more humidity it can hold. And so that is true when we look at warming temperatures due to climate change as well. And so the more water vapor, the more humidity we have in the air, the more likelihood we have of having these really big rainstorms.
I used to hear this phrase a lot more. It seems like people are moving away from it. I don't know. The 100-year flood or the 500-year flood, meaning the kind of flooding event or rainfall event you might expect once in every 100 years, once in every 500 years, whatever. What did we mean by that? And are those kind of calculations changing?
Yeah, well, the 100-year flood is not what it used to be. And so we do a lot of work trying to understand these changes. And it's made challenging by the fact that it does indeed look different in different places. And so particularly in urban areas where, first of all, you have, you know, increasing urban development. And so basically paving over natural surfaces with parking lots and buildings, that cuts down on the ability of the land to basically soak up rainfall. And so you see more runoff in urban areas as a result. It also means that that floods in urban areas really are the result of extreme rainfall, as opposed to, as I mentioned before, the other issues that can play factors, the soil moisture and the snow melt. And so what we try to do is understand in different locations, whether they be urban or rural, how these different combinations of different physical factors fit together and really translate to the likelihood of floods of different sizes, and including the 100-year flood.
Talking to Daniel Wright from UW-Madison, expert on extreme rainfall and flooding. Looking at infrastructure and flood preparedness here in Wisconsin, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has your community been hit by extreme rainfall in recent years? Did flooding result? Is your community making changes? Do you have questions for a guest about what kind of solutions might be out there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I imagine the answer to this might vary from place to place in the state. Daniel, but big picture, how well do you see us being prepared for flooding here in Wisconsin?
Well, one of the big problems that I see is that in many cases, we're using outdated information. And this is a problem not just in Wisconsin, it's true around the country, where in order to design infrastructure or to identify, you know, which buildings might be at risk of being in the 100-year floodplain, we're using rainfall data based on rainfall measurements that in some cases are more than 50 or more than 75 years old at this point. And when the climate is changing at the rate that it is, many scientific studies have shown that those sources of data that we're using for these types of decisions are really badly out of date and in serious need of updating.
What can a community do if they realize, hey, we did pretty good based on that standard you were just outlining? We're seeing now the risk is higher. What kind of changes can communities make to deal with the risk of more extreme rainfall, maybe higher runoff because of that development you mentioned?
Yeah, well, one example of this can be found here in Madison, where I live, where on the basis of recent experiences and some analysis done at the university as well, the city and then Dane County subsequently decided to strengthen the stormwater management ordinances. Basically, that means that property developers, if they were going to develop a new property or redevelop an older property, they would have to go to greater lengths to manage the runoff resulting from big rainfalls.
And what might that look like? I mean, I'm definitely seeing developments with that area left with some lower permeable surface, actual soil, as opposed to pavement. Is that something we're going to see more of?
Yeah, there are a variety of options available, amongst those being particularly in built-up urban areas, installing green roofs. So essentially, roofs on buildings that have vegetation and soil on top of them, which help to keep the rainfall in place once it's hit the rooftop. On the ground, using things like permeable pavements, which can actually help some of the rainfall soak into the ground. Things like rain gardens, so, pieces of replacing a piece of lawn with a sort of different types of vegetation and different types of soils and gravels and things that can help increase the amount of water that soaks in. But the reality is that for really big storms like the 100-year storm or even the 500-year storm, those measures are really not sufficient. And so we need to be thinking about larger scale solutions that involve more comprehensive planning, not just at the level of individual property developments, but at the scale of communities and watersheds.
We're talking to UW-Madison civil and environmental engineering professor Daniel Wright about flooding and how Wisconsin can prepare for increasing risks because of climate change. We'll get into some of those wider solutions coming up, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about the risk of flooding in your area? Or am I asking too late? Have you lived through a flood in your community? Did you feel like you personally were prepared, like your community was ready to deal with that when it happened? If so, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Daniel Wright, a civil and environmental engineering professor who leads the Hydroclimate Extremes Research Group at UW-Madison. He's with us today to look at how prepared Wisconsin is for heavy rainfall and flooding and the increased risk coming from climate change. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about flood preparedness, thoughts, maybe experiences in your own life, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Daniel, you were just talking about the need for larger scale planning, citywide, maybe countywide, and more. What kind of things do you have in mind?
Well, I think one of the important things going forward is making sure that we're working with the right information about how extreme rainfall is changing and what we should expect in the future as far as our what types of storms our infrastructure and communities might be expected to see.
And then with that information, what kind of plans can we make?
Well, I think that will help us understand how to do better infrastructure design. So for example, do our stormwater detention basins need to be larger? The answer is probably yes, but how much larger? We're not really equipped to answer that question at this point. Similarly, stormwater pipes, how much larger do those need to be? And then, at the end of the day, I think the question is really, how expensive do those changes, how expensive are those changes really going to be? Because when you're talking about limited municipal budgets, And you have to spend a larger fraction of that on infrastructure in order to deal with the impacts of climate change. That, of course, has impacts on everything else, including schools and libraries, et cetera.
Let's bring in a caller. Perry is with us in Okato. Perry, hi.
Yes. Is there any way to predict? I know, you know, soil moisture and some of that plays into it, but is there any kind of guide whatsoever of so much rainfall per hour for so long? Is there anything at all that a person can say, man, this is going to be a bad one?
Perry, thanks a lot for the call. Daniel, as I understand, you have a software tool of sorts to help answer that kind of question.
Yeah, we do have tools available. It depends exactly on what sort of information that you're looking for. So a big focus in our work is predicting what I would call the long-term likelihood of rainfall. So not necessarily what's going to happen tomorrow or next week, but rather what should we expect over the next year or coming years? Because those are really the kinds of questions that are important when it comes to infrastructure or community planning, where the decisions you're making about, you know, how to build things or zone things end up having multi-decadal lifetimes. Now, there's also a different aspect of this, which is short-term mm-hmm. forecasting, and that is the question of how likely is it to is a big rainstorm over the next day or the next week. And so those are two separate problems. We have software that really focuses on the former, whereas, you know, there's the National Weather Service and other commercial organizations that do a pretty good job of forecasting the latter. Although one of the things that's becoming more challenging as the climate warms and changes is actually forecasting these types of events, even for very short lead times, like even less than one day. Because the climate is not behaving the same way that it has in the past.
Perry, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, with that pinpoint precision, Dan, just earlier this summer, my hometown in Michigan got 7 inches of rain in one night. Where my folks live, 20 minutes away, they got under 2 inches of rain. That seems like it makes it really difficult if a weather pattern breaks a certain way, one community could face a huge risk of flood, another none. Is that part of the problem here, that sort of those small differences that can make a huge difference on the ground?
Yeah, that's right. So the exact type of summertime thunderstorms that you're describing are really where a lot of the uncertainties still lie around, you know, where we're heading in terms of extreme rainfall and flooding in a warming climate. And so we understand really well scientifically the relationship between the temperature of the air and how much humidity the air can hold, and the impact that that can have on these really extreme isolated storms like you're describing. But where a lot of the uncertainty still remains is where we might expect these storms to be moving now and in the future. And so this has to do with the location of the jet stream and how warm fronts and cold fronts are changing, where the locations of those types of things are changing in a warming climate. And that part is really still a major unanswered scientific question.
And as we wrap up, Daniel, what are you watching for next from communities around the state to see if they step up and tackle some of these flooding concerns?
Well, we're now working on trying to provide some examples here at the university for communities to potentially follow, to understand some of the cost implications of adapting to this these rainfall changes, particularly focused around stormwater management infrastructure, to really help communities wrap their heads around the costs here.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Daniel Wright, an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison. He leads the Hydroclimate Extremes Research Group that studies rainfall and flooding. He was with us today for a look at the best ways to prepare for the risks of flooding in Wisconsin as climate change makes extreme rain events more likely. Senior care facilities across Wisconsin are facing challenges with staffing and budgeting. As Joe Schultz reports, that's led to an increase in nursing home complaints and in some cases to facilities closing their doors.
In late January, Ann Mara learned that her mother would need to find a new place to live.
It was in the middle of winter. Mom is on hospice and she's 91 years old with dementia and they're evicting her. It was just disgusting to us.
Her mom had lived in the Emerald Bay retirement community for roughly 5 years. Now, the Brown County facility was telling residents it would no longer accept Medicaid funding for residents like Mara's mother, Shirley Holtz. In a letter, the facility said it wasn't getting enough government funding to pay rising labor costs. Holtz moved out of Emerald Bay in March. Her health started to fail almost immediately.
She had lost like 15, 20 pounds in 10 days that I was gone. And she had stopped eating, stopped drinking, and she wasn't responsive when I got there. And then she passed away.
Holtz died in April, and Mara believes the move played a role. But she isn't the only Wisconsinite who's had to move a loved one from a long-term care facility in recent years. Nearly two dozen nursing homes have closed across the state since 2020. That's according to Leading Age Wisconsin, a senior living advocacy group. While long-term care facilities deal with Medicaid reimbursement that's lower than the cost of care, they also face a labor shortage that providers call a caregiver crisis. Jim Orheim is Leading Age Wisconsin's president. He says staffing shortages got worse during the COVID-19 pandemic.
We saw a lot of really seasoned staff retire, and we saw an insufficient pipeline of new talent moving into these roles. At the same time, we continue to see the aging population growing. That's going to continue to put stress on the system.
As of March 2022, 51% of nursing facilities in Wisconsin reported staffing shortages. That's according to nonprofit health policy organization KFF. There's evidence that the caregiver shortage has led to worse care for patients. Last year, the state received more complaints about nursing homes and assisted living facilities than it had since at least 2018. Matthew Bowler is a Madison attorney who takes on elder abuse and neglect cases. He says his firm has seen an increase in cases over the last year and a half.
That is a result of obviously poor care, but also it certainly does relate to understaffing.
Advocates say the recent state budget increases Medicaid reimbursement and funds initiatives aimed at addressing the caregiver crisis. They are also working with the state to develop a program that would ensure inflationary increases to reimbursement. The challenges facing long-term care facilities have been especially felt in Lincoln County, where Pinecrest Nursing Home lost over $9 million since 2014. The Lincoln County Board is now considering selling the nursing home, which it's owned since the 1950s.
That's the order. So Renee, Todd, Elizabeth, Pastor Mike. Good?
In late June, about two dozen residents gathered at a county building to protest the possible sale. They're afraid it would mean fewer beds for lower-income residents who rely on Medicaid. For Reverend Michael Southcombe, selling the home is not the answer.
To believe that someone will buy Pinecrest, either a nonprofit or a for-profit entity, and keep the same level of service with 70 to 80% of the residents on Medicaid is magical thinking.
Yes.
The protesters turned in a petition with more than 600 signatures asking the county not to sell. Lincoln County hasn't made a final decision, but last month, the board considered authorizing a referendum that would have granted Pinecrest an extra $3 million per year. The county board voted down that proposal 9-13. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read that story and see a lot more from the Wisconsin Public Radio news team at WPR.org. While you're there, you can listen live to this network and check out our extensive archives as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's a lot more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.